whole topic of this convention, especially in the symposiums yesterday, remind us that at the end of the age, you know, we're going to be able to see very clearly how the nations are progressively being prepared for the great fire that will conclude it. The nations now are economically really quite dependent upon each other, and this is part of the Lord's design, isn't it? That at the same time, they all will experience, at the same time, that all will experience the result of their ongoing selfishness. The great time of trouble, we call it. Pastor Russell could certainly see a great degree of the gathering of the nations and the preparation of the elements along with the outrage of the people. But this conflict can be seen to be even than more so than in his day, even more precarious, I'm going to call it, in our day. So I'm going to share the screen now. So we're going to examine the pastor's observations and expectations and how they apply in our day, specifically the role of the modern day giants, as they were called, as one of the elements already in preparation for the great fire. At the appointed time when Jehovah will say, enough, we will see the conclusion, especially of what we read in Zephaniah and his prophecy. Zephaniah 3:8. Wait ye upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey, for my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger. For all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. Selfishness being the universal provocation for gathering the greedy leaders of government, industry, religion, everything, we'll see all of these delivered into the hands of those crying for justice. Because the common people see the only path they have for any relief is revolution. Government has failed them. Reform has failed them. This would all be very troubling, though, for us, except we know that God is the great commander who now gathers the nations and assembles the kingdoms, and his purpose is transferring earth's dominion to him whose right it is. There's a good outcome of this, as most of the brethren talked about yesterday. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth be removed and though the mountains be carried into the midst of their sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. Psalms 46:2 and 3 is certainly a prophecy for our time of the hope we must maintain, even though we see catastrophic destruction all around us, and coming more in the future. The systems are being destroyed that are in power now. So as we read this, replace the symbolic words with their prophetic meanings. Earth would be what? Society, we read. Mountains would be the kingdoms. The sea would be the ungovernable masses of people. So, this is just as Luke prophesied in chapter 17, verse 26. As it was in the days of Noah, so it shall also be also in the days of the Son of Man. This leads us to compare the conditions of course, Noah's day, to the time of the second presence of our Lord. And we've talked about this quite a bit today and yesterday. As the pastor compared the conditions, he pointed out one of the key elements corresponding to that of Noah's day. And this is focus for us of our talk. There were giants in the earth in those days, mighty men which were of old, men of renown. Genesis 6:4. This tells us that previously to the end of the first dispensation, a superhuman influence had entered the world, and power from an angelic source had produced very undesirable conditions, to say the least, to the extent of bringing into existence an unauthorized race who were powerful, self-serving giants. The pastor's supposition was that in the last days there would be a counterpart of the giants, as there was in the days of Noah, even if not specifically mentioned by Luke. So let's look at that. And then the pastor rightly pointed to certain giant monopolistic companies in his day as one of the corresponding elements to the giants of Noah's day. Those giant monopolies or trusts tightly controlled the cost for goods and services and crowded out competition in a very forceful way. They imposed on the people no real options or choices for the goods the people needed. So just like the Nephilim, these modern giants were simply overbearing bullies, which defied attempts by the trade unions and the regulatory agencies to moderate their unfair trade practices and employee treatment. This kind of behavior suggests an evil spirit influence on the hearts and minds of those men in power. Ephesians 6:12. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Well, the pastor also points out how these individuals who formed these tyrannical monopolies first received enlightenment and advantage because of being in a civilized society based on Christian principles. They first received enlightenment and advantage because of this. Very interesting. Christian principles. And so this makes the pastor, as he's pointing out, he's saying how deplorable it is that they would misuse that advantage in such a selfish way. But that behavior really fits the picture of the Nephilim of Noah's time, a hybrid product of the far superior angels mixed with humans, corresponding to today's hybrid giants being begotten by Christian enlightenment, acting in combination with the selfish hearts of fallen man. It's interesting to note the pastor's words in the 1916 foreword to Volume 4. You know, this is 20 years after the volume was first written. He says, although the trusts at that time of the time of the writing were beneficial rather than injurious, nevertheless these giants born of avarice and built up in self-interest would eventually become a menace, a danger to the people and their interests. And he says, we have reached that time and many are realizing that the danger is upon us. Well, just so you know what he was talking about, there's examples of the big trusts in the late 1800s were the steel and rail industries ruled by Rockefeller and Carnegie and the banking systems owned by J.P. Morgan, by and large. Well, these modern giants in the pastor's day were a real menace and a threat to the nation, similar to the literal giants that threatened the world with violence in Noah's day. As the Nephilim could not be controlled by mere humans in Noah's day, we are assured that, again, it will take divine intervention to fully remove these powerful and cunning modern corporate giants. So let's look at a specific incident that illustrates the point. In 1892, there was in America the Homestead Steel Strike. I'm citing this example as a kind of a provocation that will bring about an uncontainable uprising in the future by the Lord's great army. So it's something to see the similarities and recognize them when they start to happen. Well, located just across the river from the Carnegie-Pittsburgh steel plant was the scene of a brutal battle between the Iron and Steel Workers Union and Carnegie's Pittsburgh Steel members. And Pittsburgh Steel announced, first of all, pay cuts, refused to negotiate with the union, locked the workers out of the plant, and then sent in private police to bully the union strikers. The whole thing became just a simple bloody gunfight. Along with the use of the Pennsylvania State Militia, the workers' union was crushed. This all showed how hard it was to overcome a giant. A strong company that prospered under the lack of government, not really government, government regulation, or meaningful enforcement of the regulations. Another example of the influence of corporate giants was the Great Steel Strike of 1919. Now, during World War I, industrial companies, labor unions, and the U.S. government joined together to form the War Labor Board, an organization that brokered a deal to stave off strikers in exchange for improved labor conditions. They thought this was kind of a good thing. A consortium of unions that included the American Federation of Labor and the iron, steel, and tin workers called for a strike of the workers at U.S. Steel again, and the nation's biggest employer, and it was one that refused to recognize the unions. 350,000 workers walked off the job in 6 states. While the strike was temporarily paralyzed, or the steel production actually was paralyzed, the unions were eventually crushed. Again, police and company hired thugs beat up the picketers, and again, the workers and unions suffered a defeat, and a big setback was had for the steel labor movement. So, yes, monopolies and trusts were prevalent in the pastor's day, and it had been assumed, as shown in this Watchtower photodrama publication, that a great revolution leading to global anarchy was imminent, he was surmising, by 1914. But by the early 1900s, there were still signs that it may be necessary to adjust that assumption of that original time frame. Well, let me explain this. We want to note that by the early 1900s, laws and other restrictive measures to prevent monopolies were forming, including labor unions and antitrust laws. As far back, really, as 1890, the Sherman Antitrust Act made monopolies and trusts illegal. Well, these are the big adversaries before. Now they're made illegal, or let's say, not that it was enforceable necessarily. Well, the early 1900s, under President Theodore Roosevelt, empowered several federal regulatory commissions to start tearing down the big monopolistic trusts. So we're going, oh, well, people back then are saying, well, now are the giants going to be gone? Well, under President Woodrow Wilson, in a 1912 campaign speech, it's interesting, he actually referenced the phrase, and I'm going to quote it here, "There were giants in those days." It's in his speech. And then he stated, "America was created to break every kind of monopoly and to set men free upon a footing of equality, upon a footing of opportunity to match their brains and their energies." Oh, well, that's pretty flowery. That's pretty nice. And maybe he was reading Brother Russell if he said there's giants in those days. I don't know. But kind of interesting things that we sometimes forget. And then in 1914, there was the Clayton Antitrust Act, expanding the Sherman Act by prohibiting price discrimination. What's going on? We must be in the incoming kingdom, they might have thought. Well, new consumer welfare standards were also adopted in the 1970s. Now, let's jump, quite a jump ahead. And as late as 2021, as an executive order by the President of the United States, it established the White House Competition Council, whatever that means, to combat monopolistic activities and cultivate greater competition in the marketplace. In fact, in 2021, 6 antitrust bills were passed, which were designed to closely examine whether a big tech company mergers of those sorts would stifle competition. Well, Congress admits that in their assessment, not all mergers are bad for the public, and some large corporations have demonstrated they are socially responsible. Yes, many large corporations today do attempt to take selfish advantage of the public by trying to control the marketplace, but government regulations and trade unions of this time have demonstrated to be partially effective in limiting the unfair behavior of the large companies. This then resulted in what I'm going to call temporarily, emphasizing temporarily, satisfying the cries for justice, satisfying those who would be of the Lord's great army, thus averting an uprising of that Lord's great army. Well, it's interesting that Brother Russell, in the year 1916, when speculating about Elijah's mantle and the smiting of the Jordan River, was still waiting for the point when he could conclusively identify the antitype of that series of events. He certainly could see a great degree of the gathering of the nations and the preparation of the elements, along with the outrage of the people, but what was the antitype of the actual smiting of the waters, he thought? Were all the pieces of this impending event fully in place so that some incident of truth, maybe a truth message, would compel the people into an unstoppable revolutionary uprising? Well, I'm not saying we should change the idea of big business being the giants. But today, these giants are not as easily identified as the past monopolies were and the trusts were. Repeating, most big business seems only to be restrained because there are regulations. Not voluntarily, not benevolently, not cooperating for the public good. And their power in politics, government, and in social media is ever increasing. It's interesting. Let's see, did I hit the wrong button here? For example, in 2021, Congress set laws in place to force the CEOs of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google to be more transparent in their business practices. And this all sounds somewhat positive, but in actuality, the government regulations and regulators admit getting bogged down in technicalities, definitions of terms, and resistance to cooperate on the part of those giant companies. In other words, the selfish modern giants in industry have not really gone away, but they defy control and are now learning how to work around the regulations. So let me repeat, the modern giants of industry with fancy lawyers find ways to endlessly delay or altogether avert government regulations and control. In addition to working around these regulations, let's review a real example of how big business today can stifle competition and get around some of the antitrust monopoly regulations. Okay, in 2009, now that's a little time ago, but not too far back, Amazon, as an example, launched a price war against a competitor called Diapers.com, something over which Amazon was willing to lose $200 million on their own diaper sales in a single month with the ultimate goal to force the smaller competitor to sell out to Amazon. In other words, they undercut the price so far, nobody went to Diapers.com anymore. They went to Amazon, and it put Diapers.com out of business. But Amazon would say, well, what's wrong with that? We're just being competitive. Well, herein we can see, and you see on the screen there, all kinds of government agencies to regulate things. And we can see the dispute between the corporate versus the regulatory agency perspective based on all of those regulatory companies or groups. The original intention of government agencies was for the consumer welfare, and various laws were to keep companies from using unfair business practices. But from the selfish position of the giants, again, I'll repeat, it was to them just simply fair competition. Other modern-day giants can be found in the social media industry. That has a reputation of sacrificing truth, doesn't it? And public safety for profit. Monopolistic pharmaceutical companies, these are just all the lists of these monopolies, are also infamous for extracting huge profits while ignoring the welfare of the needy. And entertainment companies, movies, television, which have a few consumer controls, pretty much no moral boundaries, and fill people's minds with unhealthy and unrighteous thoughts. In addition, military contractors greatly overcharging for their services because of their grip, their monopolistic grip. So the point is that many corporations still disregard the public good and are only interested in big profits, which often means finding ways to circumvent government regulations or using pressure tactics, using lobbyists, for instance, on what is essentially just like bribery to influence government, specifically to the officials of government, to vote in a way that those officials would vote in a way that would not harm the corporation's interests. Well, it's important to emphasize again here that government regulations and trade union negotiations seem to somewhat satisfy the cries for justice for now, but this will only delay the impending anarchy of the discontented and restless masses, the Lord's great army. In addition to big business, another kind of giant has arisen that Brother Russell didn't even mention. He did a little bit with the banking industry back then, but today it's arisen even more this financial sector, which includes bankers, stock market speculators, hedge fund operators, and so forth. And this is a new kind of giant, unlike the giants of the earlier years. They produce nothing. They contribute nothing to society, really, as a whole. They don't make steel. They don't construct buildings. They don't weave cloth. They don't run grocery stores. The statement that was made is they just manipulate the financial systems, lending money, borrowing money, investing in profitable businesses, not to the benefit of the general public, but simply to the benefit of themselves, or more accurately stated, the rich owners. For instance, when the national economy and job situation was poor, as during the COVID epidemic, the government in the U.S. as well as other countries tried to ease the pain to the general public and stimulate jobs. Their idea was they pump hundreds of billions of dollars into the financial sector. It was supposed to trickle down, which is a policy that a lot of government has, is we'll give it to the corporations, we'll give it to the banks, and somehow it'll trickle down to the people by more commerce. Well, the government essentially loaned the banks money at 0% with the theory that the banks would in turn offer low-interest loans to the public for low-interest home mortgages and low-interest loans to the small businesses to stimulate the economy. But the theory failed for the most part. Instead of the money trickling down to the small business sector and the people, the financial institutes instead decided that they could make more money quicker by just investing that government money in the same, this is laughable, in the same government bonds the Fed was buying. It never went to people at all. They knew that with the government setting new low interest rates, the market rate of government bonds would go up. It was a sure thing, a sure way to profit. Former Federal Reserve officer, his name was Andrew Huszar, stated it this way.
The Fed's idea was the banks would be taking that money and lending it effectively at lower interest rates. What the banks were doing instead was that they were just investing in the same bonds that the Fed was buying. Just because the Fed wanted to do something and wanted to help the average American, it doesn't necessarily mean that Wall Street has the same interest.
Washington loaned them money at cut rate, so our thanks is they're going to stuff it in their pockets, even as many Americans are suffering from unemployment and reduced wages.
People absolutely ought to be outraged.
The Federal Reserve money was to be the blood supply for the economy. But instead of the banking system being that lifeline, the statement was made that they were simply the blood suckers. Well, the conclusion is that this new giant in the banking and financial sector is also born of selfishness. Yes, as we just heard in the interview, people absolutely ought to be outraged. And if we see this theme continuing until all the corrupt systems are eventually exposed and tore down, this theme of and the people being outraged to the point where they will tear it down is going to continue to happen. Okay, as we alluded to earlier, the Nephilim, the giants, were a hybrid of two natures, spiritual and earthly. Well, this suggests an additional modern-day entity that shares the label of giant. Mystic Babylon is a hybrid of the nominal spiritual heavens mixed with the world and earthly governments. Take a look at Revelation 18:9 and the prophetic outcome predicted in the pastor's comments from Volume 3, Thy Kingdom Come, in the 1916 foreword, and that's on page 4. And the kings, he says, the political element of the earth, which represents society, who have committed fornication, illegitimately associated with her, shall bewail her and lament for her when they see the smoke or the evidence of her burning, Babylon's destruction. So we see that the kings of the past became corrupt by their association with the elements of that harlot, creating that unlawful hybrid of nominal Christianity in the state, imposing on the people really no choice for the spiritual goods they would require, no freedom of religion, no choice but the brand of beliefs that the church-state system or nations sanctioned. But we haven't seen such a rigid Christian-controlled, church-controlled government since the end of, really, World War I. So the question is, so let's just push that out of the picture, or could this really happen again? The desire of many Christian groups, huge numbers, is certainly there. In 2022, during a political rally for the officer of governor in the city of Atlanta, proponents of what is called Christian nationalism chanted this: "We, the church, are God's governing body on earth, and we have been given a legal power from heaven and now exercise our authority." That's a little scary.
A divine mandate to change the country in accordance with the biblical values that these folks claim to have.
We believe it's time to release the roar of Christian voters across America.
They're earnest in this. And even though history has shown there are dire consequences to the personal freedoms connected to nationalistic totalitarian governments, as pictured here, selfish national pride and the desire for national identity, and especially an ethnic or religious identity, outweighs any consequences. That's what they're saying. A memorable example in the Bible history is that which is found in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Well, here, according to the Lord's directive in 1 Samuel 8:19, Samuel originally set up a unique government over Israel that would ensure fairness for all. The period of the judges here. And judges were appointed over Israel. But because the people wanted that feeling of nationalistic pride that they saw in other countries, they petitioned the Lord to replace the judges with a king. Samuel gave God's warning to the elders that kings with total control could be oppressive, that they would surely regret that request they were making. But nevertheless, the people said, "Nay, but we will have a king over us." Even back then, citing the need for a strong leader to more effectively, they would think, ensure national security. Well, more or less modern day extreme example started in 1922 in Italy with Benito Mussolini and his fascist party, which advocated government control of labor, industry, and the press, everything. Italy felt humiliated and cheated, this is the motivation for this, by the post-World War I treaty imposed by the British. And so, therefore, Mussolini's promise to the Italian people was to bring back Israel's former greatness. Let's make Israel great, or Italy great again. Later, in the wake of the World War, World War I we're talking about here, arose a parallel situation in Germany. Adolf Hitler after seeing the humiliation and the oppression of his homeland in the post-war period, vowed to make Germany great again. He set about to organize the Nazi Party and used many oppressive tactics to spread only the news that the party wanted the people to hear. Of course, Hitler knew his success would be in telling people what to think, what to believe, and then what to do. Both the Italian and German people supported leaders like these that promised their nations world prominence and respect. Well, jumping forward to 1989, after the fall of the USSR, Vladimir Putin promised the Russian people that he would then restore prominence and respect for Russia. And now today we see even more propaganda and misinformation to confuse the people and cover up government failings. But don't think that these deceitful methods are only being used in Russia and China, as we see pictured here. No, even political parties in the United States are using these methods to great advantage. How could this happen again today? We said earlier, could this? But how is it going to happen? Well, we see a pattern here of the predominantly Christian nations, including the United States, are already fearful of, number one, Islam, radicals, terrorists, Christian nationalists, and other evangelicals push the idea that Islam is a real threat to their way of life. And they point to massive immigration of Muslims in Europe that have already altered the social fabric and are causing conflict. Islamic encroachment will most likely provoke Europe to their past intolerance of other religions. And we already see far-right political parties gaining popularity. Well, at some point, if the European or Western nations become desperately fearful of Islamic threat and also fearful of collapse under the impending violent outcry of the people, you know, they've got two sides that are dangerous to them. These people wanting justice on one side, the threats of Islam on the other, and social and other economic issues, then the governments will seek, really, means to put a lid on the problems and quell the uprisings. They'll look for any means. They most likely will look to the so-called Christian political element that will calm, they claim to be able to calm and stabilize the social element. Because they have considerable influence over that group. So in this scenario, the government would avert a revolt and get stability. And the conservative Christian element would in turn be given a thrown a bone, will be given considerable control in government. But realistic, in order for this to happen, an awful lot more power would have to reside in the hands of a supportive executive branch of government. So there's still some doubt here. But at some point, interestingly, in a publication in 2022, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace stated that their analysis of world democracies which fell into authoritarianism showed that it was due to the division of society into mutually distrustful political camps. Extreme polarization. Wow, doesn't that sound like now? Then the controlling party, whoever that would be, would enact laws or enact executive orders to favor their particular Christian views, citing national security. Now, I'm not making up these words. This is this group that had put together these quotes. National security as their justification to prohibit the promotion of any ideas that they would deem as a threat to the stability of the nation. Well, even though this scenario is in the speculation category and may seem to be quite impossible to some, we do see that the hybrid of nominal Christianity with the state already has a template in Russia that can quickly be transferred to Europe or the United States in times of emergency. Well, you probably all know this, but I'll remind you that in Russia in 2002 and again in also 2016, laws targeting religious groups outside of the official Russian Orthodox Church. These laws targeted those, and these laws were deemed justified as anti-terrorism measures. President Vladimir Putin was quoted as saying, quote, "The Russian Orthodox Church is part of a bulwark of Russian nationalism, and anything that undermines that concept is a real threat, whether that is evangelical Protestant missionaries or anything else. All those who defy these new laws are faced with large fines and 6 to 10 years in prison. Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists, and so forth have been labeled as extremists, a threat to public order and public security. It doesn't mean they can't be those religions, but they certainly can't promote them in any way, shape, or form. Evangelization in any manner is prohibited, including email. The new laws make it illegal to preach, proselytize, or hand out religious materials outside of specifically designated places, or even to have religious gatherings in people's homes, terming these as gatherings of extremists. Think it can't happen here? Well, remember that there was a House bill. It was called the Patriot Act. It was passed back in 2001 because of the Twin Towers attack. And freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution, including free speech and the right to a fair trial, were essentially dissolved when terrorism was charged. The pastor expected this, and expected that the general suppression of personal liberties by government and the specific suppression of the brethren by the nominal church in alliance with the state, such as we see in Russia, would only serve to ignite the Lord's great army to the point of the great social explosion described as an earthquake in Revelation 16. I need to clarify, I think, that the threat of Islamic terror or Islamic dominance is not what the Bible students should be concerned about. Islam is just a player in this end time scenario, the agent to cause fear, to drive governments to enact stronger controls and to restrict liberty, especially on independent Christian groups like ourselves. Well, but according to the prophetic vision, the restrictions on Christian teachings and on many other social teachings will eventually cause the Lord's great army to rise up against their own so-called Christian systems that may be in collusion with the governments at that time. Remember that the pastor stated that the conflict would be irrepressible. So any situations we've seen of revolution before this time. It's always been died down until the next one comes up, but this one will be irrepressible. It won't die down. It'll keep on going. The blessing in all of this is that man's selfish schemes will fail, and the common people's eyes are opened, and they will revolt, as we said, against the untruths and against corruption. God's plan is going to reach a climax. Finally, with this, convincing mankind that they cannot rule themselves with any king or any other kind of government where selfish rules over everything in men's hearts. The final conclusion of this old order on earth will be in the same manner as with the world that was of Noah's day. That world overflowed with, you know, a literal water to destroy the evil influence on the earth. And we soon see the culmination of a great deluge of another sort that's going to overwhelm the tyrannical, political, social, financial, religious institutions of this present time. So I'm saying that the shackles of ignorance will be broken and dispelled by the increasing water of truth from our returned Lord. Sufficient light to compel even reasoning minds, good people today with reasoning minds, to take even violent action to throw off all injustice. People that normally wouldn't be violent. Eventually, under the administration of our Lord and the church, the light from our returned Lord will fill the hearts of all who will desire and appreciate truth and justice. Habakkuk 2:14, quote, "For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." This is the amen to our lesson. The refuge of lies and evil finally being swept away by the waters of truth. You know, we've spoken about what will happen as the old order on this earth goes down. But we have not spoken yet as to our role in all of this. We should be cautious then that all of these chaotic events do not cause fear, which would prompt us possibly to be caught up in the world's struggle. This would be a serious distraction from our real mission as consecrated saints. Remember that Noah, even withstanding ridicule, kept preaching and kept building that ark. Noah had faith in God's words, even though there had never been rain before that time. Well, the analogy is for us is that even though some predicted events may sound unreasonable to many, we should put our trust in the prophetic illustrations in the Bible and the pastor's predictions rather than the disinformation swirling around from nominal Christianity. And I'm singling them out especially because a good guideline to follow is to rule out any prophetic suggestions coming from the nominal churches and internet evangelists. What has been suggested to their minds is most often from the great deceiver. From James 1:12 in the English Standard Bible, "Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised." May the Lord bless us all in the months and years ahead, hopefully not too many years to go, that we may be not deceived and that we will continue to fortify our faith with the harvest message. May the Lord add his blessing.